Let it go. Keep talking. We can then we'll find out when we're on the tape. So you've got a page on U.S. mobile support there.
Yeah. Well, this was an exercise I went on, and I wrote a great report on it, and it manifested itself in the course of time with the building of the provider.
Just be able to see if we're on the tape.
Go back to Korea. At one time, they decided to support the Canadian ships for one reason or another that I'm unaware from Kure. But that was the British place, and apparently,
where you ordered lorries, not trucks.
Yeah, and the Canadian troops, our Jolly Jacks, were horrified when the meat was brought on board, and it was marked Australian ox meat. And there were a lot of other things that they liked to have that they couldn't have. And so everything was done to get them back to Sasebo again. There's a funny story which is attributed to somebody, it was told me as gospel, that Sue, your old ship, was lying alongside an RN destroyer, and apparently the RN troops used to go in, this was when Sue had had her galley all updated, and, you know, chamfered up, and she had bunks and all the rest of it. And the RN rates used to go and look in the scuttles into the galley and see the steaks are frying on the great thing. The next morning, at Hands Fall In, the number one of the RN destroyer was heard to say, I don't want you chaps going on board the ship alongside. They're Canadians and they live differently than we do.
That's true.
It certainly is. But, no, I think Korea, from the point of view of somebody who wasn't there, but had a distant, if you will, connection with the logistics of the thing, that that was a... Hi, Alma.
Hi.
How are you?
Now showing me an album of February 1947, where you wangled yourself a trip with who?
Well, it was with the Service Force Atlantic, which is the mobile replenishment force with the U.S. Atlantic Fleet. And...
47, yes.
47, right. And...
there's the Azores.
Yes.
And there we are. Yeah.
Norfolk, where we sorted from.
Yeah.
There were a number of Canadian observers on this exercise. Mickey Sterling, for instance, was on board one of the carriers, the Leyte, I think. And the fleet was quite a handsome one. The Missouri was the battleship, and the carriers were the Midway, one of the Midway class, and the Leyte. And I think there was a there's Leyte.
There's a 16-inch prodge for the Missouri going on board
from an ammunition ship called the Great Sitkin.
Yeah.
And
what was what's that ammunition ship called?
The Great Sitkin.
S-I-T-K-I-N?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I started out on board a fleet oiler called the Chuckawan, and then I was transferred to the various other ships. There was an AKA which was acting as a store ship called the I forget what her name was, but maybe AKA 92, but I forget her name. Wyandot.
W-Y-N-D-O-T. Okay.
And then I went aboard a provision ship, reefer ship, as they call them. What was her name? And there was also a hospital ship in our, I didn't go aboard her. And then I was transferred by a destroyer to a cruiser, the USS Fargo, and we came home. But it was my first real introduction to the
fleet train.
Yeah.
There's the USS Fargo, F-A-R-G-O.
She was one of the cruisers in the task force. To the fleet train and the functions of the fleet train. Now, this was in the relatively unsophisticated days. Now, the Americans and ourselves, have developed one-stop replenishment ships, where you can get fuel, food, stores, and ammunition.
And toilet paper.
And toilet paper. This was the area, and the rigs were the forerunner of today's oiling rigs that they had. And I got all these photographs thanks to a USN captain, this fellow, Captain Rosendahl, an Irishman, who...
R-O-Z-E-N-D-A-H-D-A-L... D.A.L., Rosendahl, yeah.
He, and this was another chap somewhere, he had a chief petty officer photographer, and they were making a film of the underway replenishment for the U.S. Navy, and he very kindly gave me all these photographs, which I incorporated into my official report, so I could illustrate everything I was talking about.
So you must have written that report in 47 or 48?
47.
And it must be on file somewhere.
It's on file in the headquarters.
It's on file in headquarters.
I drew it years later, had a look at it.
Jack Stay?
That's Wyandot, yeah.
W-Y-A-N-D-O-T, Wyandot, and there's Chuckawan, C...
Well, Chuckawan was here. Yeah. And
C-H-U-K-A-W-A-N.
Yeah. There was the Chuckawan, the Caloosahatchee, and won't spell it. But on this particular trip, Highline trip, when I got to the destroyer, they said, "Where's your life jacket?" Well, I said, "They didn't give me one." Bloody fools.
Well, that's a good album.
Is this thing still running? Well,
yeah.
Let's turn it off for the moment.
Well, here's one of the west coast of Norway, not that it has an east coast. Well, if we could now cruise on for a thumbnail sketch of the rest of your career, see what emerges. Let's get up to the... What started under Claxton as integration, we all agreed, was a fairly good thing. We had integrated. We never had our own tooth rights. The doctors could move around.
The doctors couldn't, but were pretty restricted to the Navy.
They were. But...
the chaplains were...
Why have a rear admiral ordering stores to the Navy, the same rank ordering stores to the Air Force, and the same rank ordering stores for the Army when it's only a logistic problem, is the way I put it, however inexpertly. Yes, it's a logistic supply problem. Perhaps one man could handle all three. That was the thinking when Claxton first started the integration bit and the services college. So then that changed. There was a certain amount of sense of that, and never below command level. Now, how did you see those years? It started with Claxton as integration and ended with Hellier as unification.
Yeah, well, I personally didn't have any strong feelings on the Claxton era. I still think that Claxton was the best Minister of National Defense we ever had. Certainly the best in my service time.
Many people have said that.
He was there for 9 years. He had no illusions. I happen to know him well because he was a contemporary, more or less, of my brother's. And he used to be, long before I was in the Navy, when I was a small boy, he used to be a guest at our house and spend weekends with us, with my brother. As far as the Naval College went, it was such a small outfit because our intake was relatively small that I didn't see. I don't remember getting emotional about the fact that it was started off being the RCN-RCAF college. And I don't remember any particular reaction to that. I did, as I had mentioned earlier, my time as in Naval Air Supply and Fleet Stores. And I must say that Naval Air Supply, possibly because I was more interested in it, took about 60% of my time, and the other 40% was on the fleet stores. I do remember one incident which I think deserves mention, and that was in 1947, late. Ah, wonderful. Thank you, Dalma.
Did you get
Jigsaw
Burger
Top and
there's cookies?
Mm-hmm. That's known as a Pose
Cafe. Okay.
But these are grand. Shall we?
No, let's keep talking.
Well, all right. And it was an interesting period because at that time the Director of Naval Aviation was an RN officer on loan. And quite apart from anything else, he was a salesman. And he was trying to sell us all the latest things from the RN. And there was another school of thought which I belonged to, that we should, in order to maintain the state of the art in our fleet air arm, we should buy not necessarily the latest, but good American aircraft, which we could get at cut rate. In the first instance, we didn't do that. We brought over Seafires and Firefly ones, and then we replaced the Sea Fires with Sea Furies. And unfortunately, the Sea Fury, we were the first squadron to have them operational, which was a grievous mistake. Before the RN had them in squadron service. And we had a great many teething troubles with them. They were a wonderful aircraft. They were. The flyboys could talk better on this, but they were the fastest propeller-driven aircraft. Fighter aircraft. But for the first 2 years we had them, they spent most of their time sitting on the ground because we ran into spare parts and maintenance problems, and our source was 3,000 miles away. Anyway, in around the 1st of August 1950, I was appointed Naval Secretary. No, 1947. And I was Naval Secretary and the Secretary of the Naval Board until end of June 1950.
You were a captain now, I think.
Well, I started as a commander and then I got to be a captain. An acting captain, yes. Actually, I didn't get confirmed till I came out here. It was probably one of the most interesting jobs I've had in my whole naval career. I've always described it as bathing in the saliva of the horse's mouth. And it was, you saw everything, and you knew
it. You knew everything.
And you had to keep your mouth shut, of course, but it had many rewards.
Of course, you've been doing that since childhood by reading letters upside down and reading CVs you weren't supposed to read and reading intrepid files that you weren't supposed to see.
Well, nobody said I couldn't. But it was a fascinating time. H.T.W. Grant was Chief of Naval Staff. A wonderful man. A very indiscreet man, too, or at least careless. He used to make little notes on his desk about forthcoming appointments of admirals and things. And he tucked them into the corner of his blotter, and he'd go home. And I, or his secretary, who was Vern Howland, we had adjacent offices, we used to go pick these things up and lock them away. Of course, quite inadvertently, we read them in the process. But it was an interesting time. It was the time, amongst other things, when there were great battles between the Air Force and the Navy as to whether we would retain a fleet Aeron. And the CAS and a lot of his higher officers were very anti-fleet Aeron. And the Navy was very adamant. And at various times there were moves to abolish the carrier, and of course the carrier squadron.
Was the matter of integration discussed in those days? Takes us up to 1950 now.
Not really.
Not really, no. It was proceeding at a leisurely pace. All right.
There were lots of crises of various kinds. I do remember, though, a milestone. In 47, during the winter, before I left my air and fleet storage job, a lot of the work in the fleet stores especially was getting rid of stuff, wartime stocks that had been left over, and running things down, closing satellite activities, etc. We got a directive from the minister, who was Claxton, that as of that day, we were to stop running down and start building up. And literally, we took files and threw them and said, PA it, that had awaiting action on disposal. And we just shifted gears. We went from running down the Navy to building up the Navy.
This is from 47 to 50, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, part and parcel of this whole thing was the building program, Saint Laurent class, the minesweepers, and deep vessels before the submarines, but we acquired the Grilse, and then we sort of rented some RN A class submarines that operated at Halifax. But the close to 3 years as naval secretary was a very interesting time.
Were you relieved by Al Solomon?
No, Henry McCandless.
Henry McCandless relieved you, and then Al Solomon. Mm-hmm. He was there. I hit headquarters in 1960. Where did you go from naval secretary then?
I came out here as command supply officer.
So now you're back west with Winsome and Patrick as command supply officer.
And Tim.
You've added one, Tim.
Tim.
As command supply officer with Four Rings.
Yeah.
That's 1950. Tim, that's when Korea was on.
And Andrea was born out here.
Oh, yeah.
And born on St. Andrew's Day, 1950.
Hence her name.
Hence her name. But we'd chosen that for Patrick, but we kept having boys.
Well, I have a daughter called Victoria. Guess when she was born?
24th of May.
That's right.
Bloody funny.
Then
from there...
So then you left here as command supply officer and went back to where?
I went to Halifax, where I was command supply officer all over again.
Yes.
And only I had nothing to do with the dockyard there. And then I spent 2 years there.
That's 1952.
To 54.
To 54.
I was always hoping for 3 year appointments.
Yeah.
I kept having 2 years.
We all.
Well, then in
1954, you left Halifax.
Yeah, and I was appointed to headquarters as deputy supply officer in chief.
At what rank?
Captain.
Captain.
And then a year later, in 55, August, I guess, I relieved Tony Wright as supply officer in chief. And that was another job that I enjoyed very much. Now, I've mentioned that I had a taste of the USN on this service force exercise. But one of the happier things of my time as by officer in chief was our close working with the USN Supply Corps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good.
And we got tremendous cooperation from them. We introduced an exchange, officer exchange program, which brought many benefits. And I used to be invited...
Ken Roy went down to Mechanicsburg.
Yeah. I used to be invited to the annual meeting of all the admirals of the Supply Corps.
What rank are you now?
Well, I got eventually to be a Commodore.
You were Supply Officer in Chief as a Commodore, mm-hmm. Yes.
And they invited me to attend their planning conference annually when there were 14 Supply Corps admirals present, myself. And to show you how welcome they made me feel, I was allowed to stay in for all classified briefings from the operational people. And we were I was the only foreigner there. There were no Brits, Australians, or national Chinese, or anyone. And I have made many good friends in the Supply Corps. I'll keep in touch with them. Well then, I was almost 5 years.
That's between deputy supply officer and chief.
In fact, I was over 5 years counting my job of deputy, I was 6 years in the supply officer in chief side of things.
So what?
Well, to come 1960, one day.
And Claxton is now gone.
Yeah. I forget who the minister was.
Parks, maybe.
Probably. Anyway, one day I went to see CNS about something, or he must have sent for me, because normally I didn't visit him very often. And he said, how long have you been in that job? It was Harry DeWolf.
Yes.
And I said, over 5 years. Well, you can't stay there forever. But I said, I don't make the appointments. I said, I'd be delighted to go and do something else. Well, corrupt. So I went back to my office and I thought, gee, now, the one thing I don't want to do is for excitement. Is to be sent to the National Defense College in Kingston. So I wrote a letter to the chief of personnel, who was Ken Dyer, and I said if there was any thought of sending me to a course of my rank level, could I please go to the Imperial Defense College, because I had not had that much association with the Royal Navy, it would help to broaden my outlook. I thought that was very tactful. And to my great surprise, 2 weeks later, I got a letter saying that I had been appointed to the
You started Greenwich?
No. The Imperial Defense College is...
Oh, it's the college, of course. I think of the war course, yeah.
It's in London.
Yeah.
On Belgrave Square.
Yeah. Sorry, that's my mistake.
And it's a tremendous experience. We're still sending people there. The one-year course, when I was there, there were 67 students from 12 countries other than the British. And... there were black ones and coffee-colored ones and all the rest, but it was not only the formal, I didn't find that you worked very hard, in a sense, but we had very good lecturers. We met in syndicates and discussed things. Wrote joint papers. And then we did a number of tours. The big tour was a 5 week tour. And I went on the one to Pakistan, India, and Ceylon, which was very fascinating because I would never have seen those countries. And
now, their ties with the mother country had been severed now.
Yes, in all those cases. But we also staged on the way. We had our own aircraft, a rather old RAF it was an unpressurized transport. I forget the exact designation of it. It'll come to me.
So then that was it. That finished the year, I guess.
That finished the year.
And then what?
And then I got an appointment as senior officer in Lawrence River area and NOIC Montreal. Now, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the thought of going there, because being bilingual, I thought, well, now I can get back my French fluidity. And I went there, and I was there for exactly 6 months. When I first arrived, and I was desperately trying to find somewhere to live for my family, I had a phone call from the then chief of personnel, who was Pat Budge. And he said, I don't want you to buy a house in the Montreal area, but I can't tell you why. And he said, nor do I want you to sign a long lease. Well, I said, you're being very helpful. He phoned me at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, just try and get something temporary. We'll tell you in due course. So I think my guardian angel was on the bit, and what happened was that we found a sublet of a house in Beaconsfield for 6 months, and that worked out perfectly. Well, then in April, I got a letter from the chief of naval staff, who was Herbie Rayner, saying that it was intended that I should come to Ottawa in July. And amongst the other things I had to do, I was an honorary ADC to the Governor General, but I had to be in office in that particular job when the Queen Mum came to Canada, and she was presenting colors to the Black Watch.
So you went back to Ottawa?
As the Naval Comptroller.
Comptroller.
And I took that over on the 3rd of July 1962.
Were you then promoted Rear Admiral?
I was promoted Rear Admiral, and for once they didn't make me an acting one.
Oh, good, you've made it. Oh, good. Now, this is the time that unification was reaching its height. How did you see it? And how did your contemporaries see it?
Well, I never had any particular objection to integration, because in my experience as naval controller, it was quite evident to me that unless the government had a complete change of attitude and philosophy regarding defense, there was no way that we could continue to afford three separate services with their administrative and logistic tails. I remember the vice chief of naval staff, who was Jeffrey Brock, calling me in one day to show me the program of ships he wanted to build for the Navy. And I remember saying, but that will take all the money that the whole of national defense gets. Well, he said, we need it. Well, I said, I know, but you've got to sell it on the Hill. Of course, we didn't. O.D. scrubbed our general purpose frigates.
Yes.
And incidentally, that was a silly name to call anything. We should have had a sexy name for them. You know, a general purpose anything, it means that it can do a lot of jobs, can't do any of them well.
That's right.
Well, then, as we approached the summer of 64, more and more details came out about the thing. And we had our last naval board meeting on the end of July, 64, and it was a very emotional one in some ways. And the 1st of August, 64, we were integrated.
No, unified.
No, integrated.
All right.
I became the Deputy Comptroller General. And the Comptroller General was Lieutenant General Robert Monsell. And various people had various jobs. Like Ken Dyer became Chief of Naval Personnel. The Chief of Personnel.
Chief of Personnel.
That's it.
And he went up to Vice Admiral, and Rayner retired around that time.
He retired on the 1st of August.
Do you know Rayner's views on it, as you remember them, that he expressed in open meeting?
Of course, at that time, Hal, we had not yet faced unification.
So you're still talking integration.
Unification was in the, you know, it was somewhere on the horizon, but nobody had really spelt it out. It's very difficult to sum up somebody else's views because...
Well, if unification was still considered far away, nobody would have that set views. But I remember in 65, only a year away, it came to a head.
Yeah.
And before I left the Navy, I saw Scruffy O'Brien in a green uniform.
I lent him the necessary baubles to go and be a rear admiral. But Rayner was very discreet and tactful. And the general attitude that he reflected was, well, we have to do what our masters tell us. You know, we are the servants of our political masters. Now, he didn't say that we should all kick and scream, but he also pointed out, and something that I felt very strongly about, that we owed something to the junior people in the Navy.
Yes.
To see that they were taken care of.
Yes. In what way?
Well, after all, they were the people that we, in our various slots and the thing, had worked with. And you could say that we had got where we did. I'm talking about all the admirals,
yes,
and commodores. We got where we did through their effort.
Yes.
Or their loyalty, their,
yes,
contribution. I was in 65, 1 year away from my retirement age. So I felt that that there was no use getting too excited about the whole thing. You know, I was on my way out anyway, and I didn't think anybody would take much notice if I got all excited about it. I had my own reservations, as many other people did. But again, I never understood really what unification meant. They were talking about green uniforms.
Did you ever wear one?
Mm-mm.
Never.
Never. Actually, don't forget the unification date was 1 February 1968.
Yes.
I was on retirement leave then.
Yeah.
Part two establishment. So, I never had to grapple with this. I was told off one time. Frank Miller was the chief of defense staff, and he had been over Europe for a NATO meeting. This must have been in the, I imagine, the spring of 65. And
at that time, just to give you my time scale, I was teaching at Ottawa U.
Yes, I had remember left. That. Well, he told Monsell that he'd invited the French chief of defense staff, whose name again escapes me, to come to Canada, and that he wanted him to be given a briefing on integration and unification in French.
Uh-huh. Guess who?
Monsell sent for me. Now, Monsell is half a JB.
Yeah.
But Monsell sent for me, and he said, you'll do it. And I almost had a fit. However, I was given a captain who was Jean Allard's son-in-law, whose name escapes me at the moment, captain in the Vingt Douze. And he and I were told to wrap cold towels around our heads and go away and write a paper on integration and unification, which we did. Now, mind you, there was nothing on paper in French. And there were a lot of buzzwords that were being used to do with integration and possibly unification, for which nobody knew what the French equivalent might be, because nobody had ever had to do anything about that. So we produced a presentation, complete with slides, idiot cards and things, and in due course, I was called to the, what was CBS's conference room, and there the French general was there with his aides and everyone, and the chiefs and the chief were there, and I launched forth into this business, which I largely had to read because, you know, I hadn't had time to memorize. At the end, I said, maintenant, mon général, avez-vous des questions? With that, Frank Miller jumped up and said, we'll have the questions in English.
Yes.
Anyway.
So,
but we had a hard time to say anything definite on unification, because nobody really knew what it was all about.
Well, Bill Landymore says that he was assured time and again by the minister that the sailors would not lose their identity. Did that discussion come up in naval board meetings?
No, because naval board never really grappled with that.
Because I think Monsell resigned too on a matter of principle, more or less.
Yeah, when he was the vice chief.
Yeah.
Vice chief of the defense staff.
Yeah.
And then his successor as controller was Frank Lilly. I know him well. He's an old friend of mine.
But Monsell resigned over the unification issue, I've heard from my soldier
friends.
Yeah, well,
so did the Frank. I'm trying to think of his name. He became chairman and president of R.L. Crane. It'll come to me.
Yeah, it'll come to you. Well, so people were resigning on matters of principle, but Naval Board wasn't discussing them.
Well, Naval Board didn't exist.
Didn't exist, of course.
You see, none of these things. One of the last items that we dealt with at the last naval board meeting was to approve the wearing of what I call a baseball cap with a big peak blue. Everybody had been wearing them for 10 years because they became a necessity, and then de rigueur in the Korean business because they kept the sun out of your eyes, and the canteens bought them and sold them to the troops. But 10 years later, the Naval Board, in its wisdom, approved this as an article of official uniform.
Very good, sir.
We didn't discuss any things of the forthcoming
event. What was the equivalent then of the Naval Board?
Well, there was the...
There was the CDS and the three commanders.
There was the CDS Council, and then they expanded that into Armed Forces Council, and that included the commanders of the major commands.
Yeah, sea, air, and land.
Yeah, and material command.
And material, right?
And air defense command. Transport command and things like that.
Now,
the big crisis.
What naval officers were represented there? What we had called flag.